जय माँ। सो वी आर रेडी विथ सम अनदर सेट ऑफ माइंड ब्लोइंग लिटरली शरविंदोज एफोरिज्म्स एंड इट इज द बेस्ट एंटीडोट टू फ्री अस फ्रॉम ऑल द मेंटल कंस्ट्रक्ट्स आइडियाज डुअलिटीज इन विच वी लिव बिकॉज ऑफ द मेंटल ईगो. Ego takes a standpoint and based on that it regards events as pleasant or painful or... But these aphorisms take us to totally another level altogether and open our minds to a higher reality in which the opposites fuse. That is the purpose, because in the divine they fuse. Here they are separated. There is a reason why we have to navigate through good and bad. But in the higher reality they are completely fused. And I think this is what I was sometime back discussing, that what happens to the karma of those who are jivan mukt. So if you are jivan mukt, if you are no more acting under the impulsion of the ego and for the desired self, you may live and act in any way. Human beings may not understand, 99-100% they will not understand. Yet you are free. Because now the action is completely under the hands and reins of the divine. So this is the whole logic behind it. We'll take this sometime later. But it's basically to go beyond the dualities. So we'll... Okay, interestingly, what we are going to read is something similar. Page 166. Sorry. Aphorism number 166. The double law of sin and virtue is imposed on us because we have not that ideal life and knowledge within which guides the soul spontaneously and infallibly to its self-fulfillment. So we often hear Buddha walking away. Was it not a wrong thing to do? Now this is, if you have that soul urge, then duty towards the divine supersedes everything else. The law of sin and virtue ceases for us when the Son of God shines upon the soul in truth and love with its unveiled splendor. Moses is replaced by Christ, the Shastra by the Veda. Now this is so true, and Shivindu uses the word Son of God. Son of, S-U-N, Son of God. So actually, if you see, there are two laws that operate upon us. One is Surya and the other is Yama. Beech mein Shani, you know, somewhere in between you'll see also Shani Devta. But basically these are the two. So the law of Yama is to restrain us. So how does it, the Yama restrain us? Yam means to restrain. Yam Niyam. So Yam restrains us by the double law of virtue and vice, reward and punishment. So human beings don't go beyond a point. Why? Because if you go beyond a point, you can grow even as the gods, on whom this stain does not come. That's why it's very difficult to understand the action of the gods. So Yama is the, this law of Yama is required when we are struggling in ignorance. Yama is the child of sun with chaya. Look at the sun acting, the light of truth acting through chaya means ignorance. So Yama operates. But if you are freed, then the law of truth operates, which is what Yajnavalkya is asking for. Hiranmayena patrena satyasyapi hitammukham. So, question is, do you think this idea of sin and virtue has done humanity any good? Good question, actually. Sometimes, if you really look at it, who follows the law of sin and virtue? Those who are good people, actually. But those who are nasty, they don't follow about it. So many times the good people restrain themselves while the evil goes unbridled. So this question has a deep meaning. After all, people who are with evil tendencies, they don't care about. You may tell them and they will commit, then they will catch both the ears and do twice, thrice, uthak bathak. Or instead of four times, they will bend their knees and do a fifth time. Okay, so as Shubindu says, the law of sin and virtue was certainly necessary for the progress of humanity, when it was given several thousand years ago. So this, you know, when I was flying, I hope next time they don't take offense. Ittihad Airways. So every time one was coming direction to Mecca and the other was time to prayer. So 8 hours, 7 hours. I said, instead they could say, right now you have 7 hours when you can commit as many sins. Then you have time to pray. After that you turn toward. It's so strange and funny. Is it something to be even reminded of? But it was necessary at a point of time. So we see, actually it is a Semitic concept. It's not so much a Sanatan Dharma concept. It's largely a Semitic. In Sanatan Dharma, sin is only that which is crooked and false, which is very different from a physical action. It's an intent. So if the intent is crooked, it is to deceive, then you may do all the good things outwardly, but you are basically, if it is false, you are untrue. Nowadays they say untrue to the truth within yourself. Then there is a problem. But today it no longer has any meaning or usefulness and should no longer be heeded. And very true, if somebody is doing something because of fear of punishment or because of reward in this life or another, what kind of a person he is? You should do good because you feel this is the right thing to do. Because good is beautiful, not because you will get some reward. And you should not do so-called, you know, wrong deeds because you will get, you know, punishment. That's how we see deception start, that we are very good in front of others, but the difference between public life and personal life. So all this is because of this. It belongs to a past which should no longer have any authority. But for this to be possible, it must be replaced by a more luminous and truer law and not by disorder and corruption. So this law is necessary when we are in ignorance. So effort should be made to come out of ignorance. If we mentally adopt it, then it can become a dangerous doctrine. That's what the mother is revealing to us. So the next question is, and what is this more luminous law? And the mother says, perfect and spontaneous obedience to the divine order that must replace all law. Very difficult. Requires tremendous courage to follow it. First to become even conscious. Because the divine then does not care about all these social ideas, notions, social duties. So perfect obedience to the divine is not an easy thing. Even to become conscious, we have to get rid of all opinions, viewpoints, desires, preferences. And then when we become attachments, then when we become conscious, then to follow it is the next step. So this is what the mother says on 26 September 1970. So the third question is it good to break all moral and social conventions as the new generation is doing? See, when is this? 70, somebody is asking this question. I thought somebody is asking this yesterday. 69. No? Nowadays we ask this. That time also they were doing it. They are our fathers or whatever. No. So, is it good to break all moral and social conventions as the new generation is doing? Don't these things have any value? Now you see, this question mother will answer in different ways. But see what she is answering here, because this is in context of what Shurvinda has said. What has value at one period no longer has any at another. As human consciousness goes on progressing. Because that's what evolution is about. Progress is about. So you can't say that, you know, what was done then, what was. And we can see it with our own eyes. There are things which was considered as good at one point of time. They are no more considered good. I mean, at one point of time, if father told you anything, you have to obey it. So I know as a youngster, I would ask this question. If your father tells you that you take dowry, will you accept it? You should not accept it because your inner being will revolt against it. If he says, no, she has to do, this is a dilemma which many, at least in Indian families, father wants it, mother wants it. No, now the criteria is what is true and beautiful. It was useful at one point of time, but now it is no more useful. To continue with that is evil. The same thing which was good becomes evil. It's not just neutral. It becomes evil. So she says human consciousness is progressing. But then she cautions, but one must take great care to replace a law one no longer obeys by a higher and truer law that fosters progress towards the future realization. So it doesn't mean I'll do anything. I'll, you know, go and take drugs because there's no law required. No, then you will have your natural consequences. But something which is truer, like when people, there was a point of time when love marriage was something regarded as a great sin. Why love marriage if boy and girl were talking to each other? Like people raised, but nowadays it's the cool thing. Now people don't, that system is gone. Because human consciousness has progressed. It needs to make its own choices. It needs to decide. There is a great degree of individuality and freedom. What we need to at the same time understand is, one has no right to abandon a law until one is capable of knowing and following higher and better law. Where is the higher and better law? That's the beauty. So he says, Shastra by the Veda. So where is this Veda? It's in the heart of man. This will never lie. This, at least my, whether you act according to it or not, your deeper heart will never lie to you. It will tell you what is true. What is beautiful, even that will tell you, because this is the seat of the divine. Mind will take you in a maze. Yes, this is okay, but there is also this, if this is, it will take you in a circuit. But heart never lies. So that's where one should listen and not to the desired self. P.S. Mother adds, read again what I wrote yesterday. I had already explained this to you. So the person finally asks, how can one follow this higher law? Mother's answer, at every moment, do what God wants. That is here. His verdict is here. Very often what God wants is mixed in human life with desired self. So sometimes we throw the baby with the bathwater. So only when we have extricated the desired self completely, then we get to know the will in its purity, because invariably it comes mixed in the human consciousness and creates difficulties. Now a little bit about Muhammad and Christ. So Muhammad's mission was necessary. Sometimes, see, Shubhin, those words, I just, you would miss it. I'll read again. Muhammad's mission was necessary. Okay, so why was it necessary? Else we might have ended by thinking, in the exaggeration of our efforts at self-purification, that earth was meant only for the monk and the city created as a vestibule for the desert. So this was, you see, Christian piety, Christian forgiveness, this is what was, you know, there before Muhammad came. So there was all this about, now what did Muhammad do? His actual war, if you see outside, within they fought, but otherwise it was primarily against Christianity. These people have extended it to India, and this was the wrong thing, and obviously they got at one level beaten black and blue. At another point they also continue to create nuisance. But the point is that with Christian, see how they fought with each other. Actually, all the wars, if you see during that time, and there's a whole history in Spain where I went, there's a very interesting history how the Muslims took over from the Christians, then how Christians fought back, they took over. And then now they are trying to create a sort of harmony, but of course, the Ghazwa-e Muhammad is there. But basically he came to, what did he come to show? The force. This, you can't neglect force and just be all love and kindness. When all is said, love and force together can save the world eventually. But not love only or force only. That's why whatever one may say, it won't work out. Either way, if you have all love, it won't work out. Christians have understood it. If you have all force, it won't work out. That's probably, hopefully, let's hope the Muslim world understands. Therefore, Christ had to look forward to a second advent. And Muhammad's religion, where it is not stagnant, looks forward through the Imams to a Mahdi. So there is the concept of second coming even there. If you Google search, you'll find what is about the Mahdi. So, but the hardcore will say, no, this is the last one. He is the final prophet. Similarly, in Christianity, you have both these things. Similarly, in Buddhism, we have both these things. But Sri Krishna comfortably, coolly said, I'll come again. I come again and again. So we don't have an issue. But basically, it's about that there is something else which has to come, the final avatar, who will embody force and love together. That we see in Sri Aurobindo very clearly. Love and force, the Divine Mother and Sri Aurobindo. Okay, so we don't understand why God does what He does. So if we would understand God, we must renounce our egoistic and ignorant human standards, or else ennoble and universalize them. So example is that, you know, people often, they say, God is very cruel because this happened. That's not the right question. Right question is why it happened the way it happened. And if you don't have any preconceived notions, then we'll be, very beautiful things will be revealed. For example, one of the things is about death. All the time people ask, young man died, young this died, suffering. But then that's about the form. That's not how the divine vision sees. It sees far beyond. Sometimes an illness or a disease in one life is the working out of great problems. It's like a clearing the path. Many things, 100 ways. No universal. So he says, or we must ennoble. Ennoble means don't think only about oneself, selfishly. Then one cannot understand God's play. Ennoble. And second, he says, universalizes them. Meaning thereby, am I the only person who is suffering this way? That I am trying to find a personal meaning that God is making me suffer. When we universalize, then we'll see that, well, wherever there is attachment, their suffering will be there. You just can't help it. Wherever there is ignorance, there will be pain. So that's what Sri Aurobindo is reminding us. So the mother says, to the human way of understanding, the world is terribly immoral, full of suffering and ugliness, especially since the appearance of the human race. So it is difficult for the human consciousness to accept that this world could be the work of a personal God. Because for man, it seems to be the work of an omnipotent monster. And that's how, you know, people ask, and they have a reason. But there is something we don't understand. So mother says, but Sri Aurobindo adds that it is better to try to understand instead of condemning. How do we understand? And surely the best way to understand is to unite with this supreme consciousness so as to see as it sees and understand as it understands. This is certainly the only true wisdom. How to unite? So she says, and yoga is the true way of uniting with the supreme. So if you want to understand the divine, become divine. And it's very easy to understand when a child does not understand why parents do what they do. So what do parents ultimately say? They say, okay, when you grow up, you will understand. As simple as that. So when we grow up in consciousness and become nearer and nearer to the divine, even we don't have to unite, that's a wonderful thing. But even before that, we begin to understand the play, why things are happening the way they are happening. So we have that, you know, Mahabharata, one of the commonest example. And so one of the things that Krishna reveals, and Sri Aurobindo mentions that in, I think, Yes, this is on the Gita. That sometimes it's better to stay the, you know, aggressor by the hands. Even it's a release for them. See, we think, oh, Karna died. They make so much. Arey, Karna's soul would be super happy. Oof, thank God you released me from my foolish promise. If you ask me in very square terms, he has made a very foolish promise. Placing promise above dharma. Some people ask, but I have promised. I said, promise is okay, try to keep it. But no promise can be above dharma. No promise can be above the divine. And that too, promise is made in ignorance. If only, you know. So this is where one has to understand that, to understand God's ways. So people ask, then why did Abhimanyu die? How do you know that his soul did not want to be immortalized thus? Today the yardstick of valor is Abhimanyu. Some souls may want to leave a stamp like that. So we don't understand the play because we are living in a little selfish world. In fact, so many died. The entire Kshatriya, that kind of arrogant Kshatriya, that kind of vital which has, you know, become too much into power and egoistic ambition, that was wiped off. Only 18 people survived. So it was, of course, each one according to their attitudes will come back. So in India we have this idea that they'll come back, and they will come back in based on what was their state of consciousness. So again, question related to that is, because a good man dies or fails and the evil live and triumph, is God therefore evil? People ask. And Sri Aurobindo himself is replying, I do not see the logic of the consequence. So we hold our breath. Why not? If a good man dies or fails, of course God is evil. He says, wait. I do not see the logic. I must first be convinced that death and failure are evil. So many people who succeed in life lose their goal because they succeed. They have a lot of money, they have a lot of success outwardly, but they have forgotten. They suffer also inwardly. That's why they want to enjoy parties. Often people ask, I said, what to do? They are suffering. They cannot sit alone with themselves for a moment. They are so much in pain, so they want to run around. They want to forget themselves, forget their pain in all this gathering. So look at their suffering. I know some people, very rich, but suffering inside because of this. But they are successful outwardly. So he says, first I must be convinced. I sometimes think that even when they come, they are our supreme momentary good. But we are the fools of our hearts and nerves, and argue that what they do not like or desire must of course be an evil. What a humor. What I don't like or desire, and if that happens, God must be evil. So, disciples, modern disciples, they are not going to leave as simply. So they ask, but what about those who are unlucky and always fail in everything they do? I know some people. I keep telling them, keep remembering the mother and go through it. So what is that advantage? I said, you are depositing your divine development bank, cosmic limited. What else you want? If a persistent failure makes you remember the divine. So mother says, first, once and for all, you should know that luck, good or bad, does not exist. It is the working of forces. It's not like, oh, something, arbitrarily God did something. What to our ignorance looks like luck is simply the result of causes we know nothing about. It is certain that for someone who has desires, when his desires are not satisfied, it is a sign that the divine grace is with him and wants through experience to make him progress rapidly. When the desires are not satisfied. So cool. So like those whose desires are not satisfied, they are in the line queue for divine grace. See, the whole thing changes completely. By teaching him that a willing and spontaneous surrender to the divine will is a much surer way to be happy in peace and light than the satisfaction of any desire. Eventually one has to learn this. Unfortunately, most are slow learners, and they waste so much time in just complaining. And poor God at the end, he has no choice. He can't pass the complaint to anyone else. So he gives light, but if we are open. All these are going in sequence. 176, when I look back on my past life, I see that if I had not failed and suffered, I would have lost my life's supreme blessings. Yet at the time of the suffering and failure, I was vexed with the sense of calamity. Shobindo's own life, if you see. When he came to the prison, he says, why me? I have not asked anything for myself. I have asked only for the country. And then Sri Krishna says, the bonds that you could not break yourself, I have broken for you. Because we cannot see anything but the one fact under our noses, therefore we indulge in all these snifflings and clamors. Be silent, ye foolish hearts. Slay the ego. Learn to see and feel vastly and universally. Basically, to be free, we have to come out of this prison. Another very interesting one, aphorism 187. 187 aphorism. Shobindu says, okay, maybe I will just read 186 also, because people are often asking nowadays, why Trump has come? He's a bad guy. Now, you know, what to say, such superficial understanding of life. He may be a bad guy. I'm not a notion. Well, what if God can do better work with a bad guy? Maybe God wants somebody who can punch people and not show one thing and be another. So, Shobindu says, the contributions of evil to the good of the world and the harm sometimes done by the virtuous are distressing to the soul enamored of good, because it wants to see good. Like with India, you see always it's been Republicans who have done good. The rest of the people say good things, but never practically. So soul gets distressed. Why this fellow? They would have wanted, there's some goody-goody chikna fellow comes and does good. But it doesn't happen sometimes. So soul is distressed. Soul is not. Soul is also used in soul enamored of good. It is still in under the spell of the sattvic. There is a stage at which the soul, feels sattvic things and good in terms of good and evil. It's still in the state of duality. Nevertheless, be not distressed nor confounded, but study rather and calmly understand God's ways with humanity. In aphorism 187, in God's providence there is no evil, but only good or its preparation. I have a very simple analogy to that. No? Before the rosebud comes, there are thorns. Why do thorns come? So that the roses are not eaten away by all the animals. That's my logic. How do weeds come around? In the farmland, because these weeds prevent from many of these insects and other things which may come and eat them away, the grains. So weeds are there. So how the providence has provided things. And everywhere we'll see something like that. Virtue and vice were made for thy soul's struggle and progress, but for results they belong to God, who fulfills himself beyond vice and virtue. So mother says, vice and virtue are inventions of human thought for the needs of evolution and progress. But in the divine consciousness, vice and virtue do not exist. And that's one answer Sri Aurobindo gave. Why shouldn't divine use greatness in any form? Why should he care for virtue and vice? So he gives example of three instruments of God in the Western world context. And the three instruments were, one was Shakespeare, who stole deer, that's how he puts it. Napoleon, who was, drunk, debauched, all kinds of things. And then he goes on to Winston Churchill. What excess you cannot attribute to him. All three were God's instrument. Now look at Arjun. You look at Arjun, he's a very good guy, okay? But he's also a little bit, people would say he's a little flirtatious, but Arjun is an instrument used by the divine. The Gita is not given to anyone else. It's a unique scripture. Of all the sages and saints, seers, sitting on mountaintop ascetics, There is nobody to whom such a wonderful scripture is given except to Arjun. What are his qualifications that way? That's where the divine vision. It does not care for all these, human notions. Now people often say, we had this fourfold order, Brahman, Kshatriya, Vaishya and Shudra, now they are broken. Now what is going to come? Some people feel we should come back to that, and all that, war of words is going on. Now what is Shurvindo's thing upon? What was this system? The old Indian social ideal demanded of the priest voluntary simplicity of life, purity, learning and the gratuitous instruction of the community. He was supposed to just give knowledge, not for money, but out of the... This was the priest, and he had to lead a life of voluntary simplicity. Of the prince, war, government, protection of the weak and the giving up of his life in the battlefield. Of the merchant, trade, gain and the return of his gains to the community by the free giving. That's how the business class was supposed to help in governance. And then of the serf, the Shudra, people often say about Shudra, of the serf, labor for the rest and material havings. So is it not bad? But, Shobhinda writes, in atonement for his serfhood, it spared him the tax of self-denial, the tax of blood, and the tax of his riches. Shudra could, if you read to Manusmriti, Shudra could lead his life any which way. There were no proscriptions, prescriptions, restrictions. He was not expected to fight in the battle and risk his life. And he was not expected to give money to contribute to the society. So then, we understand it in and there are some very interesting on idea of poverty, and Shobhinda very clearly says that poverty is not the ideal that India should, nobody should follow, but the existence of poverty is the proof of an unjust and ill-organized society. That, of course, and he says something very interesting. Ramarajya, nowadays we speak about. Valmiki, our ancient epic poet, includes among the signs of a just and enlightened state of society not only universal education, morality and spirituality, but this also, that there shall be none who is compelled to eat coarse food, none uncrowned and unanointed, or who lives a mean and petty slave of luxuries. So this is the ancient Indian ideal. Okay, this one. Tragedy. Aphorism number 212. So we say, oh, somebody died, what a tragic thing. Always says, death we associate with tragedy. You should sometimes ask the person who is gone, do you want to come back? He may say, not in the same family for sure. Sorry, but I mean, you never know, he may say, my God, thank God I got released. Okay, so whatever pain ho gaya, don't bring me back. I have had enough of this fellow. Who knows? I'm just saying this idea of tragedy. But how does the divine look at it? So Shobhinda says, poets make much of death and external afflictions. But the only tragedies are the soul's failures. There is a mission which is planted in the human heart. And the soul goes back, not fulfilling it. That is really tragic. And the only epic, man's triumphant ascent towards Godhead. So this the divine's evaluation. So Karna's life is tragic, extremely tragic, but not at all because of social injustice and all that. You've got to look at that man, he's Suryaputra. he has got still some understanding of dharma, but the fellow fights, is forever on the side of evil, stands by evil, supports evil, even knowing that this is evil. This is the tragedy of Karna's life. Therefore, he dies the way he dies. His life is not tragic as, you know, B.R. Chopra's Mahabharata makes it. His life is tragic because he lost his. Even if you see Ravan's life, it's a tragic life. A person who in the beginning is a bhakta, he is spreading the Vedas, doing such wonderful things. And how he falls to the ground, which is dies at the hands of monkey, army of monkeys, and apparently, according to him, man. The tragedies of the heart and the body are the weeping of children over their little griefs and their broken toys. Mummy, my toy is broken. Smile within thyself, but comfort the children. Join also, if thou canst, in their play. So you're not telling us be insensitive and say nobody dies, nobody is. No. Inwardly you must see this, how human life is in ignorance. It doesn't understand. And comfort them. Sometimes strange things happen. I remember once a man who was very politically connected, and in the very beginning a tease. So he used to always, I am there. So, you know, a leader of one of the Congress wings, and 200 people will come at one thing. And it so happened that his wife died in the most foolish way during a minor surgery. There was a need of blood which also may not have been done. And now in a big hospital, dying because you have mismatch of blood. It's something unbelievable, unpardonable. She died. And he was shocked because he thought that I have so many people at my beck and call. And always used to say, he would call me Bade Bhaiya. And that day, because he's young and, you know, his children and died, so I didn't know what to say. So I went with one of the Gita's commentary by Sri Aurobindo, Maheshwari ji, from Crisis to Liberation. I just put my hand there and gave him, with all compassion in the heart, gave him the book. And I said, I understand your grief and wait for time to unfold. Of course, time passes and his life radically changed. And I met him even recently. He says that was the turning point of my life, and I am so good has happened after that. So much good. He says she was a nice lady, it's not that. And then he got remarried to another, and everything worked on. I mean, you have to understand that we see the surface momentary event. But if we can only wait with faith in the grace, then, okay, one last one that we'll read. 231. What are the indispensable virtues that we must have? My favorite ones. So, at least so many virtues, no? So, which one we should cultivate? 231, aphorism number. Courage and love are the only indispensable virtues. All the generosity, forgiveness, all this, leave aside, at least. And actually, if you see, they are the root of everything. All the other ones, they come from love. And actually, love implies courage. If you don't have courage, you cannot love. So, courage and love. Even if all the others are eclipsed or fall asleep, these two will save the soul alive. You're not even qualifying what kind of courage, what kind of love. If you have in your heart, you will go through everything and ultimately will be led. Then what about the sins, virtues and vices? Which are the vices? Gambling, drinking, smoking. What are the other vices? I don't know. Okay. Going to, God knows. Anyways, vices. So what are the vices? So aphorism 232. Meanness and selfishness are the only sins that I find it difficult to pardon. Who is saying this? Sri Aurobindo, the vast compassionate. meanness. And what is meanness? It's a selfish movement turned upon oneself. Only thing about oneself, one's own advantage. This is meanness. Smallness, pettiness. Meanness and selfishness are the only sins that I find it difficult to pardon. But then the Lord, all compassionate, says, yet they alone are almost universal. He says, whom will I can? Therefore, these also must not be hated in others, but in ourselves annihilated. All selfish impulse. And actually, again, all other things, fear. When people ask why there is fear, it's one is lack of faith, but more importantly, the moment you have a desire, you will have fear. And the more it is only me and myself, you will be afraid of everything, because you are, in Hindi, I spoke once, somebody was asking about sukh. I said, sukh ki cha hogi, to dukh tumhare dwar aayega. If you seek pleasure, pain will knock at your door. But if you can throw away this desire for pleasure, you will never be worried about pain, because there is nothing you are going to lose. It's only when you want to possess something, old, then you are afraid of losing it. Then see, nobleness and generosity are the soul's ethereal firmament. Without them, one looks at an insect in a dungeon. One who is not noble. See, noble is the Aryan culture. Arya. That's what you see in men like Arjun, Ram. What nobility. To what extent they could practice it. Vasishth, ideal of forgiveness and generosity. It's okay. Take it. It's yours. No, it's mine. Now I'm going to snatch it. No. That generosity. Not like somebody snatches away. No, not like that. But mother's ideal that is her play towards the future. When a lady's husband, he has fallen in love with someone else, and both are in love with each other. What does she do? She says, okay. Carry on, but just see that your love is beautiful and noble. Don't let it be dragged to an animal level. And then she says, as for myself, I know that only divine love can satisfy the heart. So no grudge, nothing. That's called a generous heart. This is mother's own life, by the way. But she doesn't put it like that. That's a generous heart, is ready to forgive, to understand. And finally, 2, 3, 4. Let not thy virtues be such as men praise or reward. That is dikhava. So, but such as make for thy perfection, and God in thy nature demands of thee. And this is something which the divine would know. Nobody from outside will understand that what's going on inside. So if you have virtue, true, genuine virtue, yes, he's saying, divine will understand. And then disciples are disciples, so they ask, mother, please define all this. They, of course, put it like, please define. Courage, love, all this. So these are excellent, worth copying and pasting in the soul. I was going to say pasting. This on page 282 of volume 10 of Collected Works of the Mother. I had done this, so that's why I'm just sharing it. One. Courage is the total absence of fear in any form. Two, love. Often people say, love. What is love? Love is self-giving without asking anything in return. So there is no other love, actually. All this qualification of love. If you have expectations, if you have demand, don't use the word love. Pyar hai ya vyapar hai? You can't abhi vyapar hai, abhi pyar hai. Not. So love is about giving. Three, meanness is a weakness that calculates and demands from others the virtues one does not possess oneself. You are expecting others to behave in ways that you yourself. Four, selfishness is to put oneself at the center of the universe and to want everything to exist for one's own satisfaction. God must move around me like the genie in the bottle. Fulfill all my desires. Otherwise, what kind of God? What is his use? What is his benefit? Yeah, it's better. Such a God is not for you. So that's selfishness, where everybody should be for oneself. If somebody says, does something which is, and you'll see sometimes in the olden Indian families, perhaps olden families everywhere, I don't know, but Indian family, patriarchal, boss is father, whole thing should be around him. If he says yes, yes. If he says no, what kind of a foolishness is this? I mean, he may be right, he may be wrong completely. So now in every house there is Kanhaiya. Kanhaiya doesn't listen to papa, mama. He does his own will. So this is how center of the universe. You can't think that everybody, somebody, the whole family should listen and act according to. And at every level it used to be like that. 5. Nobleness. What is nobleness? Is wonderful, is to refuse all personal calculation. This is a poem of Sri Aurobindo on love. He says, you gave me one brief kiss for which I gave my life. And then he says, should I calculate? Then it won't be love but a shopman's heart. And then he says, you gave what you could give. I gave what I could give. See the difference. You could give only this. That's your limitation. But I sealed myself for life. That's my whatever limitation you may say. So this is without calculation. That movement flowers all the time. If they calculated, I don't know what is going to happen. Sun, rain, none of the trees, they don't calculate. That's how human, uncalculating, unselfish movement that is so beautiful. And finally, generosity is to find one's own satisfaction in the satisfaction of others. The song, no? Kisi ki muskurahaton pe ho nisar. किसी का दर्द अपने दिल में ले उतार, किसी के वास्ते हो तेरे दिल में प्यार, जीना इसी का नाम है. That if you are happy in the happiness of others, so that if you are satisfied with the satisfaction of others, that is generosity. So even this, if we can cultivate, leave aside big things, this is on the path to supermanhood. Because if human consciousness is still with the animal way of life or the small narrow way of human life, then where is it ready for the higher truth? Look at Sri Aurobindo's own life, putting all the money in one place, and then he says, I trust. What kind of life? Generosity. What? Death for a few stones? What an ideal of forgiveness. The story on Vasishtha and Vishwamitra. Look at it. Mother, we have heard about people giving gold to or things to gurus, no? Mother would keep them in the store and give it. She's given to so many people. Some gold brooch, some gold ring. Her own sarees and expensive she sold to run the ashram. This is the way they have shown us the way. Not even having a room for herself till 51. That's how they have shown the path. What is nobility? What is generosity? What is selflessness? What is courage? Having no fear, absolutely. Mother and Sri Aurobindo, we see that. Mother, somebody wanting to take over the ashram. And mother says, tell him to come. He got completely shocked. Who? Sri Aurobindo's nephew? That now his name, so now it belongs to me. Everybody is afraid, mother. Tell him to come. So this is called our ideal example of all these qualities we can see in the mother and Sri Aurobindo. Chema.